This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's no control over these, you know, whether internationally or locally in the United States. You know, these things have gone entirely unregulated and no one knows who's supposed to clean them up or has any control over stopping them from spilling in the first place.
What is a Nurdle, you ask? Is it the latest variation on the popular New York Times puzzle Wordle? No, not quite. Nurdles are the tiny little petroleum-based building blocks of the plastics industry. And they are literally everywhere. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Neil Dinesha to learn about the role Nurdles play in the $500 billion global plastics industry and why they're a big problem for the environment. Then we revisit part of our discussion with Dan Austin, the founder of the 88 Bikes Foundation. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Neil Dinesha. He is a tech and climate reporter for Vox. Neil, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, May 5th, that came out in Vox on Nurdles. And yeah. I had never heard this term before, but I'm sure I've seen them and I'm sure they're in my life as we speak. They're everywhere. What is a Nurdle first?
So a Nurdle is a lentil-sized piece of pre-production plastic. It's usually this little white orb that's produced in the trillions every year by petrochemical companies around the world. And then they're used as essentially the building block of all plastic products. So they are melted down at factories and then put into casts or molds, and out will pop, a water bottle or a steering wheel or a sewage pipe.
And the name sounds like somebody just made it up, like a widget. But do you have any etymology on the word Nurdle? How long has this term been around?
That is a great question. Everyone I asked has been kind of confused by this. So Nurdle is not the proper name for these things. The real name for these things are pre-production plastic pellets or resins is what the petrochemical industry calls them. But the word Nurdle just seems to have come out of nowhere. When I looked into the etymology, one of the possible sources is the wave-shaped gob of toothpaste you see on oral care packaging. Colgate and GlaxoSmithKline actually went to court over this a few years ago. That was the word that they used for that little piece of toothpaste on packaging.
And they didn't want to call it a thingamabob.
Yeah, exactly. So they called it a Nurdle. And then and then somehow that sound made its way over to these plastic pellets. And when you look at them, you can sort of see why they're called Nurdles. They're weird little objects that, you know, you would sort of make up a nonsense word for because you don't really know what else to call it. And I guess that's sort of how it stuck. If someone was like, that's a Nurdle.
All right, so let's talk about the dark side of these Nurdles. They're produced in the trillions, as you mentioned, and you would think that these beaded forms are fairly easy to transport and keep from seeping into the environment because they would just be used on an industrial level to like melt down, as you mentioned. But that's not the case. They really have kind of inserted themselves into far more flora and fauna than I'm sure their manufacturers intended.
That's right. Nurdles are escaping from the production process constantly. An estimated, I believe it's 200,000 metric tons of Nurdles are estimated or escape into the environment every year. That adds up to about 10 trillion Nurdles because they're so light. They're only about 20 milligrams. And like you said, manufacturers never intended for them to be in the environment. That's not what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to end up at a factory somewhere. But manufacturers also don't seem to care enough to stop them from getting into waterways, which is usually how they get into the environment. You know, they're spilling out in all kinds of ways. They could be spilling out of bags in transit. They could be falling out of rail cars, out of shipping containers. They're getting out there all the time.
So we should mention that they're made by petrochemicals. Why don't you kind of explain the building blocks of these building blocks themselves?
Yes. So the basic way that they're made is that a company will take oil or natural gas, and through a process called cracking, they'll turn it into something like ethylene, which, you know, they then will turn into a long spaghetti-like tube of plastic, which then they chop into thousands of tiny little pieces, which turn into nurdles. And so all of these things are, you know, oil and gas byproducts, which, yeah, eventually turn into the plastic products we use every day.
And are there any gradations of nurdles in terms of when you mention drink bottles, you hear about some plastics that are BPH-free or something like that. Are there BPH-free nurdles, for example?
Yes. So, you know, all those things that you hear, you know, whether BPA-free or BPH-free, that's dependent upon the composition of the nurdles themselves, right? So all these nurdles come in, they're made of different kinds of polymers. So they all look the same, but the actual composition of them can vary, you know, per instance or per manufacturer. So definitely there are different kinds of nurdles if you want to get down into the nitty-gritty of it. And one of my sources, when I was reporting on this story, actually analyzes different kinds of nurdles that he finds in the environment to see what they're made of. And he's trying to build a database of all these different kinds of nurdles. So he's been seeing these variations on the regular.
And how do they differ from other microplastics, notably like these microbeads that we heard a lot about being banned in terms of, I think they were in shampoos and things like that back in the day?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess to begin with, microbeads are sort of, you know, they are at the end of the day probably made out of nurdles or something like them. But nurdles themselves, from the beginning, when they're manufactured, they are microplastics because they're less than 5 millimeters in diameter. And so to begin with, they're actually the second largest source of microplastics because of the nature of their existence. Like, you know, just from the beginning, they're microplastics.
So the number one source of microplastics are the degraded larger plastics?
The number one source of microplastics is actually tire dust, and that's a whole other story, which I did not get into in my story, but it's definitely interesting. And then nurdles are the second largest source of microplastics. And when I say they're the second largest source, part of it is because so many of them are getting into the environment, but also because they do break down themselves over time. So they're already small, and so they're already microplastics, and then they break down even further, and they turn into even smaller pieces of plastic that then, you know, make their way into things like our bloodstream. You know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, nurdles are all pre-production materials. Most microplastics that we see nowadays are the result of consumer materials or post-production materials that have then, you know, been improperly disposed of and then broken down. So, you know, a water bottle, for example, could break down into smaller microplastics over time. But this is that plastic before it turns into that plastic, if that makes sense.
Be more drastic.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Neil Dinesha. He is a tech and climate reporter for Vox. So, Neil, you were talking about how these nurdles, these building blocks of the microplastic world of the plastic world, how they begin as microplastics and they end as microplastics. So that sets them apart in terms of the microplastic world. They haven't degraded. They're just in the form that they were produced, and then they kind of escape from the manufacturing process. To me, that would signal that there's more hope on the nurdle front, that we can kind of harness this pollutant easier than some of the plastics that degrade. Is that an overly optimistic viewpoint, or is that realistic?
No, I think that's totally realistic. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the reason these things are escaping is because of, you know, gaps in the manufacturing process, right? Like, and it's always through really mundane little ways. You know, they're slipping around rail cars, they're falling out of cracks, literally they're falling out of cracks, or they're like, you know, falling into drains somewhere at a factory. And there are best practices that people have come up with that could stop these nurdles from getting into the environment, you know? And the problem is that none of the plastic companies have any incentive to clean them up, because it's just cheaper to let them keep spilling than to install the barriers or the fixes that would need to be installed to stop them from leaking into the environment in the first place.
What are some of the examples of better practices that could stop them from leaking?
I mean, these are so, like I said, these are so mundane. So for example, nurdles are blown into rail cars using these pneumatic hoses. And when they're not properly attached to the rail car, they can spill out around the edges of the hoses. And so one fix is just put a tray under the rail car's loading area that would catch the nurdles as they fall off. And then you can, you know, reuse those nurdles into the next loading of the rail car instead of letting them spill onto the ground and then getting washed away or blown away.
So it's just a toaster tray, basically, in under the rail car.
Yeah, something as simple as that. I mean, I guess it would be a large tray, but, you know, it's a tray at the end of the day. Or you could put, you know, a mesh grill on a drain that would stop the nurdles from getting through. And then someone would have to come through and empty the grill every now and then. But, you know, it's just a simple little fix here and there. Or the bags that are used to transport nurdles during shipping could be toughened so that they don't split apart as easily, so that, you know, the nurdles won't escape.
So, Neil, why don't you tell us about your reporting experience? You went down into the Gulf, and maybe you can kind of highlight some of the areas where nurdles are most prevalent.
Yeah, I mean, so the Gulf of Mexico is a petrochemical hub, as you probably already know. That means that a lot of nurdles are produced in this area. I specifically went to New Orleans, which was the site of a very large nurdle spill in 2020 when a shipping container was blown off a ship and fell into the Mississippi River, and it was full of nurdles. And so I went down there to sort of see what the pollution there, what the nurdle pollution there looked like. I walked along the Mississippi River with one of my sources, or rather we drove along the Mississippi River. We walked at various points along the river to see where all these nurdles, both from that spill and from unidentified other leaking sources, were washing up on the side of the river. And I also went down to Grand Isle, Louisiana, which is at the down at the coast of the Gulf, where, you know, I walked with this oceanographer at LSU, Mark Benfield, who's been studying microplastics and nurdles for quite a while. And we found evidence of nurdles that were washing up from just leaks that had totally gone unreported, because there is no reporting mechanism around these things. Yeah, in doing that, I sort of wanted to get an idea of what it really looks like on the ground when these things are, you know, washing up all the time.
And did these experts kind of give you a better glimpse into how nurdles affect ecosystems?
Yes. You know, nurdles affect ecosystems in all kinds of ways. Well, I mean, to be clear, I guess I should say that plastics in general are kind of a big question mark in terms of how they affect the environment. This is still an area of a lot of debate and study. But it's becoming increasingly clear that, you know, they're harmful. What nurdles do in particular is that, you know, when they're in the water, they absorb toxic pollutants, and then they also attract plankton, which give off dimethyl sulfide, which is the smell of the sea. And dimethyl sulfide is also the smell of food for marine creatures. And so marine creatures tend to eat nurdles. And so this can have all kinds of effects. You know, first, the nurdles can just pass the pollutants that they've absorbed up into the bloodstreams of these animals that eat them. But also the animals could just starve to death because they'll fill up on these plastic pellets, which provide no nutrition.
And can't be digested very easily, I imagine.
And they can't be digested very easily. And so they'll feel full. And so they won't eat anymore. Or they won't eat as much as they need to. And they won't get the nutrition they need to stay alive. And so they'll starve to death without even realizing they're starving. And that's like a very visceral sort of effect that my sources told me about. And, you know, then there's also like all the other knock-on effects. You know, plastics are endocrine disruptors. And so animals who ingest these nurdles could end up having developmental issues, or they, you know, the nurdles, when they break down into smaller microplastics, can make their way into the animal's bloodstreams. And so there's all kinds of ways that these have an effect on the environment. And also, you know, nurdles that aren't eaten by animals just, you know, they wash up onto the environment, onto shorelines, and like what they can do when they're there is still unknown.
So when I first started reading this story and it taking us into the microplastic world, and you were in New Orleans, I was thinking, well, these might be byproducts from Mardi Gras beads and things like that. But
right,
that's really not the case in terms of the New Orleans connection. It was more just like the Gulf is that chemical strip for like 85 miles from Baton Rouge to the Gulf of Mexico. That's why you were studying it there. Is that correct?
That's right. Well, that and also the spill that happened in 2020, I was interested in, you know, like you said, yeah, there is a long strip. Basically, Cancer Alley is right there. And so there were a lot of petrochemical plants in the area that are pumping out nurdles. But also I was interested in the 2020 spill, because the 2020 spill was a really good indicator of how nurdles sort of exist in this like regulatory black hole, because in the aftermath of that spill, nobody knew what to do. And that's part of why I was there as well.
And what is their life cycle like, and do they degrade? How do they compare to like a plastic bottle in terms of degradation?
Yeah, I mean, nurdles, like plastic bottles and most plastics, don't biodegrade, right? So they don't. There's no natural process by which they will be broken down and turned back and returned to the land, so to speak. They physically degrade as in they break into smaller pieces over time, just as a plastic bottle would do. But I mean, a nurdle left undisturbed can just remain in the environment for hundreds or even thousands of years, just as a plastic bottle would.
But at least the plastic bottles are easier to pick up. What are some of the solutions that scientists are coming up with to try to clean up these escaped nurdles? Is it more like nipping it in the bud at the manufacturing leaking process than cleaning up? Or are there some solutions to trying to get these things out of fragile ecosystems?
Yeah, that is a really great question. I mean, nurdles are extremely hard to clean up, partly because they're so small and there's so many of them. When I was actually in Louisiana, one of my sources, when she was looking at these hundreds of nurdles that were in front of us, she told me that her job, she had to keep reminding herself, was to monitor and not to clean, because cleaning would just be an exercise in frustration. And, you know, people, really the best ways to clean up nurdles right now is essentially pretty manual labor. You know, when these big spills happen, it's usually people with shovels are going out and shoveling up nurdles and then maybe putting them in sieves to get the sand out, and then, you know, putting them in buckets and hauling them away. There are companies that are coming up with like these vacuum-based solutions to try and vacuum up nurdles from the sand, but those aren't very helpful if the nurdles are already in the water. And even then, you know, vacuuming up large swaths of beach isn't exactly great for the ecosystem either, because, you know, if you're churning up the sand, who knows what's going to happen to the creatures that, you know, live in the sand or have laid their eggs under the sand. So yeah, really the best solution here is to nip it in the bud, because cleaning up is just extremely, extremely hard.
So getting back to that nipping in the bud process, are there any ways to regulate plastic manufacturers to keep a cap on their nurdles, or are we just hoping that they do the right thing?
Yes. So this is the thing that everyone I talked to felt so frustrated about, is that, you know, nurdles kind of currently exist in a place of no regulation, and they don't have to. You know, it's totally possible that what states, or hopefully what my sources hope is the federal government will do, is classify nurdles as a pollutant under the Clean Water Act, which is sort of the watershed act of environmental regulation that the EPA can rely on for this sort of thing, which would then, you know, bring regulatory power to, you know, make these companies clean up their act, you know, basically. Because for the past few decades, the plastics, you know, industry has had a voluntary cleanup effort called Operation Clean Sweep, which has these best practices that they're supposed to adhere to, which have not really had much effect, clearly, because the environmental pollution keeps on happening. So the best solution, everyone that I've talked to said, is to have these sorts of regulatory changes, ideally through the Clean Water Act, that would, you know, bring some controls to the nurdles and nurdle pollution.
Seems like there's a lot of hurdles for these nurdles.
That there are. Lots of hurdles for these nurdles. The hurdles for turtles.
So you mentioned this 2020 New Orleans spill that you were investigating, Neil. What other major nurdle incidents have there been in terms of spills around the globe?
Yeah, I mean, last year in 2021, there was a major spill off the coast of Sri Lanka when a tanker carrying, you know, millions or billions, it's still kind of unknown, of these nurdles sank off the coast of Sri Lanka. And it caused what the United Nations called the biggest plastic spill in history. You know, if you look at the pictures from this spill, you just see these beaches coated in white nurdles. And there are these really striking photos of people trying to clean them up and animals crawling across them and fish filled with nurdles. And it kind of highlights just sort of how messy this whole thing is. They're just so hard to clean up. And also, there's no control over these, you know, whether internationally or locally in the United States. You know, these things have gone entirely unregulated and no one knows who's supposed to clean them up or has any control over stopping them from spilling in the first place.
Well, it's a depressing story, but an important one, and I'm glad you're covering it. Neil Dinesha, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Well, I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I've got my plastic Jesus sitting on the dashboard of my car. It comes in colors pink and pleasant, it glows in the dark 'cause it's iridescent. I'll take it with me whenever I go far. So give me my Lady Madonna, dressed in rhinestones and sitting on a pedestal of abalone shells. I'm driving 90, but I'm not scary, 'cause I've got my Virgin Mary assuring me that I will never go to hell. By the way, you know the hope will make you strange, make you blink, make you blink, make you sink. It will make you afraid of change and often blame the box with the view of the world. And the ones that fill the frame, I turn it up, but then I turn it off because I can't stand. When they start to talk about the hurting and killing, the shoes that we're filling, the damage and ruin, man, the things that we're doing. God, we gotta stop, we gotta turn it all off, we gotta rewind, start it up again because we fell across the fall line. Ain't there nothing sacred anymore?
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the founder of 88 Bikes, Dan Austin. Dan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, it's great to be here.
So, what is 88 Bikes? Explain the name and what the mission of your organization is all about.
Yeah, so 88 Bikes endows bicycles to women and girls around the world, especially the survivors of human trafficking. We launched about 13 years ago in Cambodia. 88 Bikes, the name, comes from our first year. My brother and I were in Cambodia. I was doing a documentary. He's a pediatrician. And we thought we'd ride our bike across Cambodia. And at the end of the ride, give the bikes to a couple lucky kids. We found an orphanage. There were 88 kids at the orphanage, but of course that's two happy kids, 86 not so happy kids. That's no good. Launched a fundraiser, and we got bikes for all the kids. And when the kids got their bikes at January Day in 2007, it's just this amazing scene of happiness. And we thought, wow, we stumbled on a nice niche here. We need to do this again.
And so explain some of the areas that your organization has been focusing its efforts. You mentioned human trafficking, so I imagine a lot of Southeast Asian work.
Yeah, so we're in 17 countries right now. Southeast Asia is our hub. Cambodia is still our kind of primary target country. We've worked a lot in India, Kolkata area, Bihar, Nepal. We just did a nice project in July in the Sirkat region of Nepal. We've done a little bit in Laos and Vietnam. Philippines is good. We've also worked throughout Africa and South America. And we did a small project here in the United States on the Navajo Nation a few years ago as well.
So walk us through one of these engagements in a country like India.
Yeah, so first step is, you know, connecting with a local nonprofit that's based on the ground, preferably run by locals, that works in the field of, you know, human trafficking or sometimes domestic violence, things like that. We connect with them, we vet them, and they say, okay, you know, we have this population of heroic women and girls who could use bikes. And we say, great, how many? They identify them, they send us a list, and then we schedule a trip to go over and check it out. If it looks good, we'll endow the bikes, usually 100, 200, up to 500, 600 at a time. When we give the bikes, we do so in what we call the moment of happy. That's where all the girls are gathered together. They each get a bike. They also get a picture of the person who gave them the bike. Bikes are $88. They've been $88 since the beginning. So if somebody wants to endow a bike to someone, they donate $88. We use that money to purchase the bike locally, local vendors. Money stays in the economy. Bikes that are common to the regions, so they blend right in. Theft is reduced that way too. It's easier to fix. So we source the bikes locally. We gather them together. The girls get the bike, and then they get the picture of the person who gave them that bike. And we take a picture of each woman or girl holding the picture of their sponsor, and then we send that back to the person who gave them the bike. So it's this nice, you know, this nice circuit of philanthropy where everyone's kind of in it together. There's no hierarchy. The donors love it. The recipients love it. And then the bikes are theirs. They can do whatever they want with them. And we find they usually keep them for years.
What are some of the most important uses that these women and children are finding for bikes? I'm sure for the kids, it's a lot of fun, but there's probably some real survival involved as well.
It can be. It depends on the situation. Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, the bike is just a lot of fun. But then it's also really useful. They can get to school. So there's that. It's super useful. And we find that, you know, it also can help them build businesses. We've had girls who, they were going to use the bike to start a mobile beauty salon, a bunch of girls in Laos that we gave bikes to. So there's all kinds of different applications, from being super, super fun, a sense of freedom, a sense of joy, and all the way down to just being really, really useful too.
Dan Austin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been fun, thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Curtis Mayfield, Jack Johnson, and Lucinda Williams.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.